Chapter 21, A Fresh Beginning. Almost the first thing I heard on my return to Kalimpong towards the end of December was that the missionaries, Catholic and Protestant alike, were extremely angry with me. They had good reason to be angry. During my stay in Calcutta, I had not been so deeply immersed in the life and work of Dharmapala as to forget about the three young men, two Buddhists and one Hindu, who had been subjected to tremendous pressure to become Christians, or to forget my resolve to do something about checking what I called conversion through pregnancy. David Priyaji, Dr. Soft, and other friends whom I consulted were naturally horrified by my story, though hardly surprised, and it was agreed that the best thing I could do was to write to the newspapers exposing the evil. This I accordingly did, and shortly before my departure for Sanchi with the sacred relics, a letter headed Conversion Through Pregnancy appeared over my signature in the correspondence columns of at least one of the leading English-language Calcutta dailies. Great was the indignation, not to say the fury, of the missionaries, not only in Kalimpong, but also, as I subsequently learned, throughout northeast India, where the daily in question mainly circulated. But there was nothing any of them could do against me, at least not openly, and of course no denial of the allegations I had made was ever forthcoming. Whether the missionaries concluded that conversion through pregnancy was more trouble than it was worth, I never knew, but the fact was that there were no more cases like those of Karma Tsering, Tashi Gompu, and the wretched Dil Bahadur, even though other unsavoury methods of conversion continued to be rife in Kalimpong, especially when the influx of Tibetan refugees into the town after the 1959 Lhasa uprising gave the missionaries of all denominations the opportunity for which they had been praying. The checking of conversion through pregnancy was not the only matter about which I had been concerned in Calcutta, or about which I consulted David Priyaji, Dr. Soft, and other friends at the Mahabodhi Society, nor was it the most important. I also consulted them about whether the governing body would be prepared to help me in my efforts to work for Buddhism in Kalimpong by giving regular financial support to the YMBA. They were unanimous that it probably would be, on one condition. The YMBA would have to affiliate itself to the Mahabodhi Society as a branch. David Priyaji, in particular, was very much in favour of such an affiliation. There were definite advantages attached to being part of an old, established, internationally known Buddhist organisation like the Mahabodhi Society, and as bhikshu in charge of the Kalimpong branch, I would naturally have much the same freedom of action as before. Besides, he added, there were not many sincere Buddhist workers in India, and they should work together rather than separately. In the end, I applied for affiliation to the society. The governing body accepted the application, and the Young Men's Buddhist Association, brackets India, became the Kalimpong branch of the Mahabodhi Society. 2 months earlier, at the time of my arrival in Calcutta, I would not have been prepared to sacrifice the independence of the YMBA in this way, even for the sake of a grant many times bigger than the 50 rupees a month the governing body had agreed to give the new branch. But since then, I had discovered Dharmapala, and the discovery of Dharmapala had led to the discovery of the Mahabodhi Society, not the corrupt and degenerate Mahabodhi Society of Jinnaratana and his toadies, but the vibrant, idealistic Buddhist organisation that had existed in Dharmapala's own lifetime, and that, with David Priyaji back at the headquarters building, might exist again. It was to this Mahabodhi Society, the real Mahabodhi Society, that, in my own mind at least, I had affiliated the YMBA. It was this Mahabodhi Society that, as bhikshu in charge of one of its branches, I represented, even though I never actually joined the society as a member and never took so much as a rupee from it for my personal needs. but whichever Mahabodhi society it was to which I had affiliated the YMBA, I had affiliated it without consulting our members, and it would not have been surprising if they had not been particularly pleased to wake up one morning, so to speak, to find that instead of being members of the YMBA, brackets India, they were members of the Kalimpong branch of the Mahabodhi Society. Fortunately, this did not turn out to be the case. Lachiman, Dawa, and the other more active members to whom, in the course of the next few weeks, I spoke about the reorganisation of our activities, as I called it, were inclined to welcome the change rather than otherwise. In any case, to such an extent were our members behind with their subscriptions, and so little had the activities committee done for so long, that it was less a matter of the YMBA, brackets India, becoming the Kalimpong branch of the Mahabodhi Society, as of simply setting up a branch of the society in the town, with myself and my work for Buddhism providing an element of continuity. The only person who was not inclined to welcome the change was Joe. At the time of my return to Kalimpong, the prickly Upasaka was away in Lucknow, having gone there to collect the last of his belongings, since he had recently moved to a spacious upstairs flat in the development area, not far from the bungalow, once occupied by Thubten Tenzing and his companion Thubten Shedub. But although I could not see Joe, I certainly heard a lot about him. According to Rene Nebesky, who came with his latest article on Tibet for me to correct, and who was about to return to Europe, during my absence he had been running down the Western Buddhist Order, and Robert Stuart Clifton in particular, to all and sundry. Though I had my own reservations with regard to the order, I was annoyed that Joe, who knew nothing about it, should have been so foolish as to criticise it to people whom it in no way concerned, and who, in fact, were unaware of its existence. The only explanation I could think of was that Clifton was an American, and Joe, I knew, had a pathological hatred of America and Americans, as well as of Winston Churchill. A hatred to which he frequently gave expression in the most vitriolic terms. Dawa, who had just started working for the Central Intelligence Bureau as a translator, also had something to report. Mr. Kan had taken a Tibetan boy from the bazaar to live with him, he told me, with a worried look. The boy was of a very bad character, and he was at a loss to understand how a respectable gentleman like Mr. Kan could have taken a boy of that type to live with him. He must have known what he was like. Naturally, I wanted to know what Dawa meant by saying that the boy was of a bad character. Was he a thief? But the question seemed to embarrass my former student, and he would say no more. A week later, Joe was back in Kalimpong, and one afternoon I went to see him in his new abode, taking with me Sachin, Jungi and Dawa, who had arrived at the hermitage together a little earlier. We found the chairman of the former activities committee busy decorating. He was not particularly pleased to see us and gave us tea with a very ill grace, glaring at us the while in his most forbidding manner. It was not the best time to speak to him about the reorganisation of our activities, but I did so nonetheless. He responded with a marked lack of enthusiasm, and before long was making all kinds of cutting remarks about the YMBA, about the Mahabodhi Society, and about headstrong, inexperienced young monks who were so foolish as to think they could change the world. The message seemed to be that while I was fully entitled to waste my time working for Buddhism, if that was what I wanted to do, I should not expect older, more sensible people to waste theirs. On my return to the hermitage with my three young friends, I was silent and gloomy, some of Joe's remarks having depressed me. And the following morning, feeling that no one understood me or sympathised with what I was trying to achieve, and that I had no earthly refuge, I composed a poem of 7 8-line stanzas entitled Taking Refuge in the Buddha. When I transcribed the poem into my poetry notebook, I placed at its head, by way of a motto, the words Nati me saranang nanyang, budho me saranang virang. Or, for me there is no other refuge, the Buddha is the supreme refuge. The words being taken from the Pali Tiratnavandana, or salutation to the three jewels, which I recited each morning before meditating. By this time I'd been back in Kalimpong for more than a month and had spoken to most of our members, both active and inactive, about the YMBA's affiliation to the Mahabodhi Society and about my plans for the future. On the full moon day of Magga, therefore, 2 or 3 days after my encounter with Joe, there was held at the Hermitage not just the usual full moon day celebration, but the first general meeting of the Kalimpong branch of the Mahabodhi Society. I did not expect Joe to come, but he in fact turned up early. Fortunately, he was in a more positive mood, and I was able to give him an account of my experiences down in the plains. Someone must have mentioned the Tibetan boy, for the temperamental upasaka, who was more accustomed to handing out criticism rather than receiving it, hastened to explain that he had taken the boy to live with him at the instance of my old Kamba student Agen Chodotsang, who had in fact misinformed him about the young wretch. In what the misinformation consisted, Joe did not say, and we talked of other things until it was time to repair to the shrine room. A week or two later, however, he came to see me, accompanied by the young wretch in question. 15 or 16 years old, he was handsome in a ravaged sort of way, and kept making eyes at me behind Joe's back. The octagonal shrine room, where Lama Govinda's Buddha image presided with hand raised in blessing, had been built as a summer house, and it was not easy to squeeze everybody in for the puja and the short sermon, which, as usual, comprised between them the principal part of our full moon day celebrations. Latecomers had either to sit on the front steps or look in on the proceedings through the windows. Someone had brought along a harmonium, and after I had delivered my sermon, Sachin and others sang to its not, to my ears, very pleasing accompaniment, the melodious devotional songs that were so popular with religious-minded Nepalis, both Buddhist and Hindu, and which, even when sung by non-professionals, could bring tears to the eyes and a lump to the throat. Whether there were still tears in anyone's eyes when emerging from the shrine room, we made our way through the coolness and silence of the garden back to the Hermitage proper for our meeting, I cannot say, but certainly everyone seemed to be in an exalted mood. The meeting passed off smoothly, and a new Mahabodhi Society committee was elected, with Joe overcoming his lack of enthusiasm sufficiently to allow himself to be made an office bearer. The reorganisation of our activities had received the seal of general approval. A fresh beginning had been made. Not that the reorganisation was complete, or indeed needed to be complete, or that a fresh beginning involved any real breach with the past. Members continued to make use of the games room, as well as of the library and reading room, which was given a government grant after a visit from a sympathetic inspector. Students and others continued to come for private tuition, and visitors continued to turn up at all hours of the day and night, from Tibetan lamas to English professors, and from itinerant Indian musicians to Swiss journalists and German artists. The principal difference, now that we were a branch of the Mahabodhi Society, was that membership was no longer confined to young men, and that we were taken more seriously by the older generation of local, mainly non-Tibetan, Buddhists and sympathisers with Buddhism, some of whom had their own connections with the society and respected it as the leading Buddhist organisation of India. We were also better off financially. 50 rupees was not a large sum, it did not even cover the rent, but it came regularly and we could rely on it, and I hoped I would be able to persuade the governing body to increase it before long. The fact that we had become a branch of the Mahabodhi Society and that I was bhikshu in charge made little or no difference to the pattern of my own life. It was more like the weaving in of an additional thread, a thread consisting mainly of the accounts and report of activities that had to be submitted to the governing body each month. Besides carrying on with my meditations and studies, I continued to entertain visitors, to see friends, to talk to inquirers about Buddhism, and to keep in touch with an ever-expanding circle of correspondents, some of whom had been writing to me since the early days of Stepping Stones. The activity that took up the biggest slice of my time, however, was that of giving private tuition. As at most other periods, my students fell into two more or less distinct groups. There were those who came and took private tuition in English from me simply because they wanted to learn the language for business or social purposes. And there were those who came and took private tuition in English or English literature or logic or rhetoric and prosody, as the case might be, in order that they could be sure of passing their school or college examinations in those subjects. The first group consisted mainly of Newar traders and Tibetan government officials. Agon was now taking tuition from Joe. They came once a week and were paid. They came once a week and paid, or supposed to pay, a small monthly fee. The second group consisted of school and college students, some of whom had studied with me, on and off, ever since the days of the YMBA tutorial classes at the Dharmodya Vihara. They came several times a week, even daily, and did not have to pay anything. One of those who came and took private tuition in English from me, simply because he wanted to learn the language or improve his knowledge of it, was Mr. Bhumiveda, plump and bespectacled, and with a gold-toothed smile. Mr. Bhumiveda was neither a Newar trader nor a Tibetan government official, but an elderly Thai who had left Thailand in a hurry for political reasons and was now staying at the Dharmodya Vihara. He did not come and take tuition with me alone. With him came the angry-looking Newar monk who had thrown me and the YMBA out of the Dharmodaya Vihara 2 years ago. Since his ostensible reason for throwing me out was my failure to pay him the 100 rupees a month for my room that he was demanding, anybody could hardly have expected me to give him free tuition. And when he and Mr. Bhumiveda came and announced that they wanted to study with me, he indeed made it clear that his companion would be paying the tuition fees of both monk and layman. I at once agreed to teach them. In fact, I was glad that Aniruddha and I were now on friendlier terms. At the same time, I found it difficult to understand how, having treated me so badly, he could have the effrontery to ask me to teach him, even for a consideration, especially in the absence of any word of explanation or apology for his past behaviour. Eventually I concluded that for a person of his temperament, even quite violent quarrels were nothing out of the ordinary, that he forgot them no less easily than he entered into them, and that even when making life at the Vihara intolerable for me, he had not, in all probability, wished me any real harm. Aniruddha was not the only monk who studied with me. There was also Jibananda, the smiling young Shamanera whom I had met in Calcutta, and who, shortly after my return to Kalimpong, came and joined me at the hermitage. Besides helping him improve his English, I taught him some basic dharma, taking Dr. Konza's Buddhism, Its Essence and Development as a textbook, and introduced him to the practice of meditation. Unfortunately, he was not happy in Kalimpong. A Bengali by birth, from the Barua community, he missed his Bengali friends and his Bengali fish diet, and left after staying only 2 months. I was sorry to see him go, since he was quiet and well-behaved, and I had hoped to train him up as my assistant. His departure left me with only one live-in student to teach. This was Man Bahadur, the diminutive young Nepali who had succeeded Aung Saring as my cook bearer. When the latter, having served me faithfully for a year and accumulated a small capital, left to set himself up in business as a pig breeder. Man Bahadur's most noticeable feature was his neck, which was of extraordinary length and gave his head the appearance of being set on a stalk. Otherwise, he was unremarkable enough, cooked moderately well, sulked when reprimanded, and took English lessons from me last thing at night, no doubt with a view to getting a better paid job elsewhere later on. If the giving of private tuition took up the biggest slice of my time, then by far the biggest share in that slice went to Sachin, Junki and Dawa, but especially to Sachin, who was now back in Kalimpong after an abortive attempt to do intermediate science in Darjeeling. My young Nepali friend had not wanted to do science, his interests being entirely literary, but his father, the jovial and popular Ravi Das Singh, was determined that his handsome and intelligent elder son should follow in the paternal footsteps and become a doctor. And to Darjeeling, Sachin had accordingly gone, there being no science college in Kalimpong. Not surprisingly, he did not do well. In fact, he did very badly. So badly that eventually his father relented and allowed him to return home and do intermediate arts at the local mission college. Being unwilling to lose the academic years he had spent doing science, he applied for permission to sit the IA examination the following year, but this the college authorities refused to allow. It was against Calcutta University rules, the principal told him firmly. I therefore wrote to Dr. Snehamoy Datta, the registrar of the university, whom I had come to know in Calcutta in his capacity as one of the editors of the Mahabodhi Society's Diamond Jubilee souvenir, explaining what had happened and asking if the rules in question could be waived in Sachin's case. Though friendly and sympathetic, Dr. Datta's reply was unequivocal. The rules could not be waived. I then tried another tack. Could Sachin sit the IA examination next year as a non-collegiate candidate? But this also proved to be out of the question in the end. And as a last resort, I wrote to the former Vice-Chancellor of the University, Dr. Syama Prasad Mukherjee, who was also the president of the Mahabodhi Society, appealing for his help. All this took time. In fact, I was in correspondence with Dr. Datta until mid-June, since the question of who could and who could not sit the university examinations as a non-collegiate candidate required a good deal of sorting out. Meanwhile, Sachin attended college and took private tuition from me in English and logic, generally coming once a day in term time and twice a day during holidays, besides frequently dropping in at the Hermitage outside study hours for a chat or for a game of ping-pong. The tuition in English meant tuition in English literature, especially as represented by the IA prose and poetry selections, both of which had obviously been compiled decades ago by someone whose preference was for the traditional rather than the experimental, and for the romantic rather than the classical. Thus, the prose selections included essays by Leigh Hunt and J.A. Froude, while the poetry selections featured such poems as Wordsworth's Immortality Ode, Keats's Ode to a Nightingale, and Shelley's Ode to the West Wind, and To Night, all of which I had read so many times since my rapturous first encounters with them in Faraway Tooting, that I could repeat whole chunks of them by heart. Now, 10 or 15 years later, I was studying those same poems in the foothills of the Eastern Himalayas, in the seclusion of a semi-derelict wooden bungalow set amid ornamental trees. I was studying them in the company of a gifted young Nepali who loved poetry no less than I did, and whom I had promised at the beginning of the year to help obtain a good knowledge of English literature. We studied each poem word by word and line by line, appreciating the appropriateness of an adjective and exploring the implications of a metaphor or simile, yet trying at the same time not to lose sight of the poem as a whole. Nor was that all. Whether it was a poem by Wordsworth or Keats or Shelley or any other poet, as winter gave way to spring and bamboo orchids were succeeded in the garden of the Hermitage by camellias and gardenias, Sachin and I went through each poem, not once, but many times, and I dictated him not paraphrases, one cannot really paraphrase a poem, but extensive critical notes. The greater the number of times we went through a poem, the more deeply we were able to penetrate into its meaning, a meaning that seemed, in the case of some poems, to coincide with the meaning of Buddhism itself. Once again, I realised what I had first realised 3 years earlier, namely that in explaining a poem such as Shelley's The Cloud or one of Keats's odes, I was in fact teaching Buddhism, especially when I was explaining it to, or studying it with, a dear friend. It was therefore not surprising that at the time when Sachin and I were going through the IA poetry selections together, I should have been impressed by Rilke's idea that poetry is not about existence, but is itself a new kind of existence, or that I should have thought of writing an article on what I called the metaphorical nature of reality, as well as an article on the Buddhist element in the plays of Sophocles. Next to Yeats, Rilke was my favourite poet at this time, and Sophocles I was rereading with great enjoyment after a lapse of some years. Neither of the two projected articles was ever actually written, but the kind of ideas I had intended to express in them were henceforth to be a permanent part of my thinking. Seeing as much of each other as we did, it was natural that Sachin and I should have experienced a deepening of our friendship. Such a deepening had not been possible during the 2 years that he was away in Darjeeling, though we met whenever he was in Kalimpong for his holidays, or I in Darjeeling on Stepping Stone's business, and though we corresponded regularly and at some length. But now that he was back in Kalimpong, at least for the present, our friendship not only deepened rapidly, but broadened out and became more solid, a development that was due partly to the fact that Sachin was more mature and responsible than he had been a year or two earlier, and had a better understanding of the value of friendship. He was also happier than he had been for a long time. He was happy to be again surrounded by his family and his old friends, happy to be free from the hateful necessity of studying science, happy to be able to devote himself to literature. So happy was he, in fact, that he usually arrived at the Hermitage in a lively, frolicsome mood, with the result that the time we spent together passed in the most agreeable fashion. My young friend did, however, have occasional fits of depression when he withdrew into himself and refused to speak to anyone, but these were not long of duration and tended, in any case, to be connected with quarrels within his family. Not that there were never any misunderstandings between Sachin and myself. We were, after all, of very different temperaments and from very different backgrounds. But our misunderstandings were only misunderstandings, and however hurt or upset one or another, or both of us, might have been, they were soon cleared up and left our friendship stronger than ever. Since I was 7 or 8 years older than Sachin, and a monk to boot, I could not help wanting to share with him the fruits of my experience of life, limited as Joe considered that experience to be, and from time to time gave him advice. Besides being concerned with ethical rather than religious issues, this advice was more general than specific in character, as I preferred to elucidate principles rather than lay down rules, and liked to encourage my students to think for themselves. There was one area, however, in which my advice was specific, and in which Sachin wanted it to be specific. That was the area of poetry, or rather of poetic composition. A poet in both English and Nepali, he wanted to know how to improve his poetry. This led to a number of discussions, and as a result of these discussions, I thought of writing an article to be called Advice to a Young Poet. Unlike the articles on the metaphorical nature of reality and the Buddhistic element in the plays of Sophocles, this one did get written and was published in the Aryan Path later that year. And it is now available in Wintour's publications, The Religion of Art. Apart from Krishna's Flute, an article on the poetry of Sarojini Naidu, which I wrote shortly after my arrival in India in 1944, it was the first article on a topic of literary interest that I had produced. Though intended for Sachin in his capacity as young poet, it was written quite as much for my own benefit as for his. Poetry expressed the personality of the poet. It was the more or less complete embodiment of his whole experience of life. The poet therefore improved his poetry by improving himself, and he improved himself by cultivating certain emotional and intellectual qualities. In describing these qualities, I cited a number of Western poets as well as Plato. I did not cite any Eastern poet or thinker, though I advised the English poet to learn to appreciate Arabic, Persian, and Chinese poetry. Nor did my references to the natural world so much as suggest that I lived in India. The article could just as well have been written in Tooting as in the foothills of the eastern Himalayas. Nonetheless, I was deeply affected by my surroundings. They stimulated and inspired me. And without that inspiration, I probably would not have written Advice to a Young Poet at all, at least not in the same enthusiastic manner. I was inspired by the bamboos and the orchids, by the haze-softened foothills, gashed red here and there by the landslides, by the changing cloud formations, by the breadth and blueness of the sky. Above all, I was inspired by the snows. The snows were not visible from the hermitage, but as one walked up the road in the direction of the bazaar, they gradually hove in sight. By the time one reached the Dharmodi Vihara, which was situated half a mile from the hermitage, there was the dazzling white mass of Kanchenjunga, with its twin peaks, piled up on the horizon at an unbelievable height. For the best view of the snows, one had to climb up to Dailo, the skull-shaped hill beyond Dr. Graham's homes. And one day, with three companions, Sachin and I did just that. The three companions were Jungi, Dawa and Omiya, the cheerful Bengali proprietor of a small watch repair business in Darjeeling, with whom Sachin had become acquainted, and who was now spending a few days with him. As agreed the night before, we met at Sachin's house after breakfast, and from there set out. The climb was a stiff one, especially towards the end, and it was not until nearly midday that, having emerged from the pine forest, we found ourselves on the bare top of Dailo Hill. The sun was shining brilliantly. Below us was the river Ranjit, winding through silver sands towards the plains, while around us, and stretching away into the distance, rose innumerable hills, all covered in soft blue haze. Aloft on the horizon, and extending in an unbroken line from furthest east to furthest west, were the snow peaks of the eastern Himalayas. There must have been hundreds of them. Except for Kanchenjunga and Lama Yuru, a pyramidal mountain so called from its resemblance to a meditating monk, I did not know the names, nor did I care to know them. For me it was enough to sit there in that intense stillness, 5,000 feet above sea level, simply contemplating those silent white forms. Contemplating them in this way, taking darshan, as my Indian friends would have said, I could begin to understand why the Himalayas had such a hold on the imagination of the people of the subcontinent, and why they occupied so prominent a place in the religious and cultural life of Hindus, Buddhists and Jains alike. I could understand why Kalidasa, in an oft-quoted phrase, had described the Himalayas as, quote, the congealed laughter of Shiva. And while the author of the Skanda Purana had gone so far as to personify the Himalaya, or Himachala, in the singular, and extol him as a deity, saying, "He who thinks of Himachala, even though he should not behold him, is greater than he who performs worship at Kashi. And he who contemplates upon Himachala shall have pardon of all sins. All things that die on Himachala, and in dying think of his snows, are freed from evil. In 100 years of the gods, I could not tell you of all the riches of Himachala, where Shiva lives, and where the Ganga falls from the feet of Vishnu, like the slender thread of the lotus flower. Truly, as the dew is dried by the sun, so are the sorrows of mankind dried up by the sight of Himachala." I had contemplated Himachala, and though I did not feel that my sins had been pardoned, I could well believe that my sorrows had dried up, at least for the time being. Sachin and the others, however, were growing restless. After a picnic lunch, we had lain in the sun for a while, steeping ourselves in the silence and solitude. But now they are moving about and talking. It was time for us to depart. Having commemorated our visit with a poem, which we traced out on the ground in charcoal, we therefore started making our way downhill. The return journey took nearly as long as the outward journey had done, and by the time I reached the hermitage, having halted for a cup of tea at Sachin's place, I was feeling extremely tired and quite stiff. The tiredness was gone by the morning, but the stiffness lasted for several days. It was also several days before I was able to re-engage properly with my regular activities, the darshan of the snow peaks that I had been vouchsafed on Dalo Hill having affected me deeply. Next to the giving of private tuition, the activity that took up the biggest slice of my time was probably correspondence. Letters came to me from all over the world, and I did my best to reply immediately. There were letters from old friends and letters from new friends, from Buddhists and from non-Buddhists, from monks and scholars, editors and journalists. One old friend who wrote to me was Buddharakshita. From earlier letters I knew that he was having a difficult time in Ceylon, his own Brahminical conditioning having apparently collided head-on with the Theravadin conditioning of his Sinhalese preceptors. He now wrote to say that he was going to Burma on a Burmese government scholarship. There are also letters from Raj Kapoor and from Arunjav Rask. On my return to Kalimpong, our younger members and friends had been greatly excited to hear of my contact with Raj Kapoor, in their eyes an infinitely more important figure than either Dr. Ambedkar or Lama Govinda, and many were the requests I had received for a letter of introduction to the famous actor. They were even more excited when they heard that Raj Kapoor would be visiting Darjeeling, both he and Rask having written to me to this effect. In the event, the visit did not take place, much to everyone's disappointment, but almost to the day of my departure from Kalimpong, more than a decade later, young men who fancied themselves as film stars were in the habit of approaching me for a letter of introduction to Raj Kapoor, or at the very least, to Rask. More often than not, I did not give even the latter, being unable to forget either the young men I had seen hanging about the gate of the RK studio buildings, or Rask's caustic comments on their abilities. Now that the YMBA India was the Kalimpong branch of the Mahabodhi Society, and I, its bhikshu in charge, one of my most faithful correspondents was Devapriya Valasinha. Early in March, I received a letter from him that made me realise that it was not only English-educated Hindus who were indifferent to considerations of objective truth. This letter was not of Devapriyaji's own composing, but was a copy of a letter that Dr. Sunichi Kumar Chatterjee, the nominal editor of the Mahabodhi Society's Diamond Jubilee Souvenir, had received from C. Jinnarajadasa, the octogenarian president of the Theosophical Society, challenging the accuracy of some of the statements in my biographical sketch, and accusing the Mahabodhi Society of hostility to the Theosophical Society. In his covering note, David Priyaji asked me for my comments. I had met Jinnaraja Dasa at Adyar in the winter of 1946 to 1947, when I was on my way to Calcutta from Singapore, and remembered him well, as I also did Rukmini Arundel and her lecture on Buddhism and beauty, delivered in the open air beneath the spreading branches of Adyar's famous banyan tree. Probably Jinnaraja Dasa did not remember me, or if he did remember, failed to connect the young British serviceman who had come to see him in Adyar with the Buddhist monk who was the author of the offending biographical sketch. He was particularly incensed by a passage in which, describing Dhammapala's first visit to England in 1893, I had spoken of his being welcomed at Gravesend by Sir Edmund Arnold and, quote, several theosophists, including Leadbeater and his young favourite Jinnaraja Dasa, whom he had kidnapped and carried off to England, unquote. He had not been kidnapped, he insisted, not without some harsh remarks on my failure to observe the fourth precept. The Dhammapala diaries, however, showed that he incontestably had been kidnapped, Dhammapala himself having been personally involved in the subsequent fracas, in the course of which the father of the 16-year-old Jinnaraja Dasa had wanted to shoot Leadbeater. When I wrote to David Priyaji, I was therefore emphatic that we should stand our ground. Jinnaraja Dasa would have to be told that the statements whose accuracy he had impugned, including my reference to Leadbeater's kidnapping him, were based on the Dhammapala diaries and other contemporary evidence, that hence there could be no question of our withdrawing them. Deva Priyaji accordingly drafted a letter to this effect for Dr. Chatterjee to sign, and I heard no more of the matter. Nevertheless, it had disturbed me, and I continued to think about it. I was surprised and saddened by Jinnaraja Dasa's evident desire to rewrite history, the more especially as the society of which he was president had taken for its motto a nome from the Hindu scriptures, which it translated as, quote, "There is no religion higher than truth." I was also surprised that Jinnaraja Dasa should have accused the Mahabodhi Society of hostility to the Theosophical Society. Dhammapala himself had been a member of the Theosophical Society, as well as a personal disciple of Madame Blavatsky, and in my biographical sketch I had made no secret of the extent of his indebtedness to Theosophy. I also made no secret of the concern and indignation with which the mature Dhammapala had viewed certain later developments in the society, and it was for perhaps this reason, as well as because of my reference to his having been kidnapped by Leadbeater, that Jinnaraja Dasa had reacted so strongly. End of chapter 21.